Hello, everyone. Welcome to the third episode of Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, where we explore the neuroscience behind the emotions we're experiencing in this pandemic. This is Emily.
I'm Gaia. Hi, everyone. Well, today's episode, we're going to be exploring quite a heavy and complex emotion, grief. We want to explore what is happening in the brain when we grieve.
We also want to explore how grief amplifies in a community as we grieve both individually and collectively. And lastly, we want to talk a little bit about the journey of recovering from grief. And with that, this is Your Brain in the Time of COVID-19, the grieving brain. To be honest, I'm actually still nervous about recording this episode.
Why? Why do you feel like that?
Because I felt like growing up, I have never really gathered the vocabulary to talk about death. I just feel completely comfortable talking about the most obscure details in how a fruit fly brain cell works. But when I had to describe the feeling of grief, words felt inadequate.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. Because grief isn't necessarily a topic that comes up in dinner conversations that much, is it? Mm-hmm. And I think what's worse is that in popular culture, the way characters approach death or grief, it's quite formulaic, as if there are only a couple of ways to grieve, you know?
That is so true. I feel that I had no idea what grief might feel like before I felt it myself.
Yeah.
The first time I experienced something like grief this year was when COVID-19 first hit Wuhan and the entire city went into lockdown. So every day I would scroll my phone and my entire screen would be filled with heart-wrenching posts of desperate people asking for help because they have exhausted all other means and their loved one are dying. And I couldn't look away, but I also couldn't do anything to help. There were a few days that I would show up at work, mute, and disconnected with the world around me because back when COVID had yet to hit the US and I thought nobody would really understood the pain I was sharing with strangers in a faraway country.
Yeah.
So I just felt disillusioned, angry, and on edge. And I sighed and I cried a lot. Yeah, so I really wanted to explore a little bit more about what's actually going on in me. How I just seem to have turned into this very different person. And I think a lot of people around the world are feeling this version of grief too. As the death toll climbs around the world during the pandemic and as deaths by police violence happen again and again around us, especially here in the US, grief is an emotion that really is front and center of our mind.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think what I hope we can do with today's episode is to really understand a little bit about the biology of grief. But I think it's important to preface by saying that, you know, each grieving experience is so personal. And the neuroscience can't take away from that. And we should be mindful of that. At the end of the day, you know, grief is a really difficult topic and it's important emotion to explore. If nothing, I hope that with this episode, we can start a conversation about grief.
Yeah. Okay, I have a question for you, Gaia. How would you even define grief? So when I think of grief, I feel that it's sadness, it's anger, it's a sense of loss, and even a preoccupation with what was lost.
Totally. So if you look at the definition, grief is defined as a deep distress or mental anguish that's caused by the loss of someone or something. The thing is, what that entails is so complicated by this pandemic because we're not really grieving for a single loss, right? We're losing lives. We've lost a normalcy in the world and in our lives. So many people are losing jobs and the ways we can support our living. grief is really the pain that accompanies that loss. And psychologists have tried to unpack the complexity of grief by dividing it into 5 stages traditionally. So denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance. The thing is that these stages don't necessarily occur in a particular order, and you can even swing back and forth between one or more stages. But each stage comes with its own set of complex emotions.
Wait. Can we maybe just unpack that a little bit more?
Yeah. So let's talk about one of the most human experiences, which is the death or terminal illness of a loved one. So you can see different emotions come into play when we're grieving this loss. So there's denial, which is often a common defense mechanism. This can't be happening. It's not true. We block out words. We hide from the facts. There's also anger that's directed either at our loved ones or even at complete strangers or inanimate objects. There's also bargaining, which is usually in the form of if only statements. If only I had done this before, if only we could have spotted it earlier, etc. And we might even, you know, try to make a deal with God or a higher power to try and postpone the inevitable. There's depression, which is also associated with mourning, the sadness, the worry of different aspects, like the cost of taking care of what happens next. There's also acceptance, which often comes with time and which is deeply personal. And it's a stage of calm. It's an opportunity to make peace.
I see.
And the thing is, you can see a similar grief response to the pandemic itself. So there was the denial, you know, the virus is just like the flu. It isn't such a big deal. Then there was the anger. Why do we have to have travel restrictions? Why do we have to go into lockdown? There's bargaining. Maybe if we all wear a mask or go into lockdown for a couple of weeks, then things will be better. There's also the depression. You know, I really miss my friends and family. Will this ever go away? There's also the acceptance. This is reality now. Let's find a way to deal with it. And grief is really characterized by these waves of sadness. So one can go about feeling okay, and then suddenly you feel this overwhelming sense of loss. And if you think about it, it's a really disruptive emotion, which then brings us back to the question of why did we develop it in the first place?
Yeah, why did we develop it? Wouldn't it be nice not having to feel the emotional pain that hurt us so badly?
Exactly. So I did a little bit of reading on the evolutionary basis of grief that I want to share. So some psychologists believe that grief is really a byproduct, an unavoidable side effect of attachment. So it's almost like an extreme form of separation anxiety. Remember in the loneliness episode, we discussed how attachment is the emotional bonds we develop that connect us with those around us.
Separation anxiety, just like loneliness, would have pushed us towards our loved ones, mm-hmm. our carers, or those we feel a sense of comfort or security around.
Yeah, exactly. And even though grieving itself is so painful, it originates from our instinct to be close to that person, to form that tight connection, to bring us together when we are apart, which in the end, all things considered, is still very, very worthwhile. All the reunifications throughout our lives really outweigh the pain of grieving at the end of it. Grief itself is a byproduct of what pushes us to remember the relationships that are lost and then motivate us to try to do everything that we can to fix it or find it again. It's our body's way of telling us that these relationships are so precious to us.
Wow, I don't know what to say. That is so powerful. And you know what? I haven't really thought about it this way before. Mm-hmm. I feel like to be able to grieve meant that we have been living our lives loving someone, caring yep. for something, or forming attachment to someone. Yep. And that's really beautiful.
Yeah, totally. So the byproduct theory seems to be a very straightforward explanation, right? But it's not mm-hmm. the only one. So a second theory proposes that the expression of grief can actually act as a call for help and a signal to the group that the individual belongs to that the individual is trying to cope. So this tells the grieving individual and the rest of the group to reassess their plans and priorities based on the recent change in status of the individual. And the grieving individual themselves usually receive sympathy and resources from others in the group. So I want to take an example from the animal kingdom to show this. So in chimpanzees, it's been observed that a female adult chimp with a stillborn baby has been seen to grieve, carrying the dead infant's body around, grooming it, etc., and sometimes for weeks on end. But her interactions with other chimpanzees after the birth of the stillborn increased. She also had interactions with other females who had stillborn infants previously. There's a real moral support and resources that the group provided to this grieving individual.
I see. So can we gain insights into what role grief might play in social animals? I'm thinking about the stories we read of animals that stop eating and show signs of what we might call depression in humans after the loss of a companion or offspring.
Yeah, totally. Like Dr. Jane Goodall, I think, who observed that a young chimp stopped eating and grew lethargic after his mother's death. I think it's really interesting that you mentioned this.
I remember reading that anthropologist Barbara J. King, by tracking down different animals, showed that in the animal kingdom, after death, animals too mimic signs typical of human grief. They become withdrawn, less interested in socializing, restless, or even unable to eat or sleep.
Yeah, I came across this really moving story from the Rothschild's Giraffe Project. So when wildlife biologist Zoe Muller, she was doing her rounds, she came upon 17 female giraffes and they were running haphazardly and looking really distressed. And it turned out that an injured calf had died and all these adult giraffes had gathered with the mother, like sort of providing moral support, and stayed with her for 2 days. But then on the third day, it was just the mom standing guard over her dead baby. She wasn't eating, she wasn't drinking. And it makes me wonder, do animals feel grief the way we feel it?
Yeah, from what you're describing, it almost seems like they're performing a ritual. It almost does seem like animals can feel grief similar to the way we do.
I think the issue is it's difficult because grief is so subjective and personal, right? And I'd like to quote the Italian biologist Melissa Redgente, who said, speaking of grief in animals, if you really want to be sure, we're going to have to interview them.
Is that the only way though? Like, you know how with stress, we could measure pupil dilation, sweat in our palms, or level of cortisol as a surrogate measure for how stressed we feeling inside in an experimental setting. So can we do something similar to that to gauge the grief animals are feeling?
Yeah, that's a good point. That would make it an objective way, right? Because usually we're not able to control our biology. Well, so there have been a couple of studies that have done this. So one interesting study looked at Kakma baboons in Botswana. And they studied hormonal data from female baboons that had lost a close female relative. What they did find was that even a month after that loss, females showed higher levels of glucocorticoids.
That is a stress response, right?
Yeah, exactly. What was interesting about the story about the baboons is that after their loss, they seemed to groom more frequently and with more partners. And the thought behind this is that physical contact releases oxytocin, which reduces the effect of these stress hormones. So it appeared that the females were actively trying to form new connections and increase oxytocin, trying to suppress the stress response.
That is really interesting. And I wonder how similar it is to the grief response in human on a physiological level.
I'm really glad you asked that, Emily, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about in the next section.
So grief is such an ancient emotion, isn't it? I'm guessing you have a lot to tell us about the history of grief, Gaia.
Yeah, well, it is an ancient emotion, but it's sort of been hiding in plain sight for centuries before we took a careful look at it. Actually, the first study that looked at grief happened in the middle of the last century. So it started with a tragedy that shocked the US so much that it replaced the headlines about World War II. So let me tell you this story. So the year is 1942, and the location is the Coconut Grove, which is a premier nightclub in Boston, Massachusetts. Witnesses say that they saw the first flames of a fire near the fronds of these massive palm trees that were part of the ambience in the club. And it started just below the ceiling. But despite efforts to douse it, it spread along the fronds of the palm tree, through the staircase. It spreads to a false ceiling and it showers patrons with sparks and shreds of fabric. It raced up the stairways to the main level, burning the hair of patrons as they try to flee up the stairs. And within 5 minutes, the fire has spread to the entire nightclub. The building's main entrance was a single revolving door, which was rendered utterly useless as the crowds tried to stampede out. Bodies piled up on both sides of that door, jamming in. And requiring oxygen, the fire leapt through that breach, incinerating anyone left in that pile.
Oh no, that's yeah. So scary. That's truly horrifying to be trapped with no way out like that.
492 people died that night.
No.
Later, fire officials testified that actually 300 people could have been saved if there had been better exit routes. It was a monumental tragedy, and the Boston newspapers were filled with lists of the dead and stories of those who narrowly escaped.
I can't even imagine what it must have been like for the families to find out that way.
Yeah, and it was the bereavement of the families that actually gave us this insight into what happens in our bodies and brains when we feel grief. So Dr. Eric Lindman, a psychiatrist, followed the families and relatives of the dead and then put all his findings into a paper published in 1944. This allowing us to better understand systematically what happens when we feel grief.
I see. So what did he find?
So he established some common symptoms of grief other than, you know, the sad emotions that we usually associate it with. So he observed what is called somatic distress. So grief shows up in the body as headache, dry mouth, nausea, loss of appetite, and even fatigue. There's also the preoccupation with the cause of grief. Acute grief, which is the period immediately following the loss, is characterized by the loss of regulation. So we experience sadness and anger, but also a dysregulation of our ability to conduct day-to-day activities. And most of these things can start feeling like a chore.
Okay, so that, in my opinion, sounds a lot like depression. You know how, like, the intense sadness, the fatigue, the disturbance to sleep, and the appetite. Mm. So, and also this dysregulation of our ability to engage in day-to-day activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. At first glance, there seem to be a lot of similarities. What studies have suggested is that the difference is grieving persons are able to stay connected to others, and periodically they can experience pleasure. But with depression, there's an inability to connect with others. Also, interestingly, clinical trials have shown that antidepressants don't seem to work and can't really ameliorate grief symptoms.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. I think it was C.S. Lewis who wrote, "No one told me that grief felt so much like fear," which brings us back to what happens in the body when you feel grief. And actually, acute grief looks a lot like the stress response. So remember the amygdala, the almond-shaped part of the brain in charge of stress and fear? Well, research has found that many persons who have intrusive thoughts related to their loss actually have hyperactivity in the amygdala.
Huh, that's really interesting.
The activation of the amygdala results in the hypothalamus sending out a signaling molecule, a hormone called adrenocorticotropic hormone, or ACTH, which in turn signals the release of cortisol from your adrenal glands.
Mm. So PSA new listeners, we did a whole episode on the stress response in our first episode. You may want to check it out. So Gaia, would you say that cortisol is being released in a prolonged manner when we grieve?
Precisely. So higher levels of cortisol and a dysregulated HPA axis are consistently seen in bereavement. And as we've covered in the first episode, this chronic stress response can wreak havoc on our bodies. As cortisol levels remain high, it weakens our immunity by suppressing inflammatory pathways, and it even raises our blood pressure. And you know how we hear stories of elderly couples or really close family members, and then when one member dies or one spouse dies, then the other, even though they are healthy, passes on soon after?
Yeah, we always say that they loved each other so much and wanted to be reunited again, or that they cannot bear the grief.
Yeah, so grief can indeed be a very heavy burden on our bodies. In fact, a study from the University of Birmingham found that elderly persons who have recently lost a loved one become more vulnerable to infectious diseases. In fact, there's also another thing. There's something called the broken heart syndrome. It's thought that the stress hormones like cortisol can result in abnormal heart movements and chest pain that result in a heart attack. In fact, a 2012 study found that a person's risk of having a heart attack increases 21 times in the days following the death of a loved one, and then 6 times over the following week. And research has found that after the death of a spouse, people are more likely to self-medicate and even have aggravated physical pain. Multiple epidemiological studies have verified the excess morbidity and mortality following the death of a loved one.
I think I can relate to that because sometimes when I feel really, really sad, I do feel pain in my heart. And I used to think that it's all just in my head. And honestly, I think it's so important that we start to appreciate the effects of long-term persistent grief on our physical well-being. And to recognize that this will be the scar that stays with us a little bit longer, even after we invent the vaccine to COVID-19, that we don't just automatically go back to normal. And one thing is for sure, we all just need to lean on one another and help each other out as we grieve during this pandemic for all the things we have lost.
So there was a quote from the Japanese filmmaker Takeshi Kitano that really illustrated the gravity of communal grief during a disaster. It wasn't one case of 20,000 people dying. It was the case where one person died, happening 20,000 times.
Oh, that is so true. And I feel like it's especially accurate in the age of social media. Like during disasters, in addition to traditional news, we tend to rely on a lot more on social media as our news source for gauging the situation, especially when we perceive traditional news source as slow, biased, or in some cases even censored.
Yep.
So on social media, we are confronted by the gravity of the disaster on each individual person.
Yep.
It was someone's dad, someone's grandma, someone's daughter, someone's classmate.
Yeah, and that grief is also amplified by people reposting and sharing. So even when we're physically away from the center of the disaster, we could be hit repeatedly with just how scary and horrible and sad it all is.
Yeah, in the past 5 years or so, researchers have started to pay attention to how emotions ripple through our social media network. So there is a well-known psychology phenomenon called emotional contagion, which is when we catch emotions from those around us. When we look at their faces or posture and see them being happy, excited, angry, or in pain, we also feel the same emotions.
But then online communications are a little different, right? Because it's predominantly verbal. Can we still catch emotions from others? Like even when we don't see their faces or postures?
Yeah, turns out we can. Scientists have teamed up with Facebook engineers to study specifically how emotion contagion can happen on a massive scale through Facebook. So they reduced the amount of either happy or sad posts to close to 700,000 Facebook users and observed how that affects the amount of happy or sad posts these users produce.
Sorry, what? Are they even allowed to do that? It sounds ethically highly questionable to me. I mean, usually in experiments with human participants, you have to get their informed consent, right? I mean, they should have the freedom to drop out of the study whenever they feel like, right, Em?
I totally agree. So according to this paper, apparently we had all agreed to Facebook doing this to us when we created our Facebook account.
What? Like when we were 15 years old. It's ridiculous how much they can get away with by sneaking stuff into fine prints. They could have worsened someone's mental health without, you know, knowing or being able to stop it. And nobody knows what it could have butterflied affected into, you know?
Yeah, I totally agree. It's highly, highly dodgy. And I mean, in addition to other highly dodgy things Facebook do to us on a daily basis, and they also did this concurrent study where they just observed how rainfall in a city impacted the amount of positive posts by residents in that city, and by extension, positive posts by people who are friends with those residents.
So it seems to me Facebook could have just made that point with the second study alone.
Basically, yeah, I know. It's gross. So if it makes you feel better, none of the other studies I read was this manipulative.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's definitely not common practice and really, really frowned upon. Okay, so coming back to our current situation, this pandemic, as we know, is pretty unprecedented. And there are studies deposited on paper archives, but they have not been reviewed by fellow scientists yet.
Yeah, yeah, you're totally right. Because basically anyone can upload there. So we have to take studies in those archives with a grain of salt. But, you know, there have been so many other traumatic events. Has anyone studied those?
Yeah. So scientists have carefully surveyed people and their online behavior after, say, a terrorist attack or a natural disaster. So after the terrorist attack in Paris, young adults who use more social media reported to be more emotionally distressed. The authors speculated that after a disaster, negative emotions circulate on social media, making it harder to regulate our own negative emotions.
I see. So it's like an echo chamber of heightened grief.
Yeah, that is so true. So for a few days, I had multiple group chats running where all we talked about was sad and infuriating news because grief was what everyone was feeling, and it became harder to step out of it. And we just kept ruminating on it over and over between our friends.
Yeah, and I think it may have been compounded with the stress you're feeling. You might, you know, keep checking and sharing the news out of anxiety, out of how little control you actually have over the situation.
That is definitely part of it. I think the grief was actually very, very complex. Outside of the emotion we naturally felt when we see other human beings suffer, there is also an additional undertone of despair. Because the pandemic had exposed a lot of ugly failures in our society, in healthcare, welfare, economic system that we depend on for a living. And our collective grief was a reaction to that kind of betrayal.
And that collective grief can be a very powerful force.
Yeah, a powerful force for change. So I had witnessed incredible momentum and unity in social media where people were united by this raw collective grief and compelled and emboldened to say, no, we have had enough to corruption, to censorship, to inequality, to violence.
Ooh, just hearing you say that, I feel like goosebumps. You know, I came across this study about social media use in Saudi Arabia after natural disasters, and it really spoke to what you were describing just then. The amplified emotions during the disasters really helped the public overcome social and personal restraints that are normally present, and it enabled and emboldened more people to express dissatisfaction and even to take collective actions through things like protests.
That was really, really powerful. But I guess we cannot forget that there is a lonely and debilitating side of grief when we lose someone dear.
Yeah, I think losing someone in COVID is especially hard in the family, right? Because of the contagious nature of COVID, which means that a lot of people don't have a chance to properly say goodbye to the people they love.
Yeah, it can be extra traumatic to the family. For patients, for example, who pass in ICU, where visitors are strictly controlled and deaths can happen quickly and unexpectedly, the families tend to experience a longer period of grief because there's this sense of ambiguous loss. The fact that there is no closure or proper goodbye can make us feel disempowered, regretful, and frustrated.
Yeah, and also grieving during a pandemic has so many unique challenges. For example, without schools or work, church, or without being able to see friends and family, it's a lot to process, and it's harder to process that grief alone.
Yeah, I know that rituals such as burials and public funerals, which can offer comfort and support for the family, are also temporarily restricted in some countries due to the pandemic. So I was reading about how the journey of navigating grief might look like when all the odds seem to be against us. Like, how can we still reach that acceptance?
Tell us about it.
So the first step is to recognize that it's okay not to be okay. Grief is a normal and natural response at this time. We might want so badly to be in a different state of mind right now, understandably. And the oscillation of emotions can be really confusing or scary. But we have to be patient with ourselves. Give ourselves the permission to feel whatever it is we are feeling.
Yeah, sometimes we have these cookie cutter expectations of what grieving looks like. But it right. really can be different for everyone. You may feel numb or irritable or any other emotion that could be different from those around you and actually could take you by surprise. It's okay to feel how you feel.
Definitely. And I also want to speak to how we can be better listeners when those around us are grieving. So personally, I used to make the mistake of trying to get my grieving friend to feel better or to cheer up. I'd want to fix things for them because I love them and do not want to see them in pain. But it is so important to remember that when we listen to our friends, we should accept the state of mind they're in and give them the time and space.
Yeah, that's really critical. You're right. Because otherwise, our friends might feel like they cannot really be themselves around us. I also feel it's extremely important when we grieve to have an outlet for our emotions where we can freely and honestly express our grief.
That is so true. So this outlet could be journaling, could be art, could be talking to a therapist. And mental health professionals really encourage a strategy called name and claim, where we try to distill our vague, wordless suffering into concrete language and images. And by doing that, we can own our emotions.
Yeah, that could be the start of getting a handle on our situations. When we lose a loved one, often we feel that we have also lost a part of ourselves and that connection we have with that person. The person we are when we're with that person, the things we do together, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes what people do is to find a new way to honor the connection they have with the person they lost. For example, to do good deeds in their name or to write out their stories. Other things that some people find helpful are to take care of our bodies by eating well and relaxing and to stay connected with friends and families around us using technology, even if we can't meet up with them in person. Also, it has become increasingly easier nowadays to seek counseling help online if you need them.
Yeah, these are really good things to try. But I think, you know, it's a really personal journey. And honestly, whatever works for you is what you should do.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So with that, I think we have come to the end of what we plan to discuss today. Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast and want to support us, please give us a good review on the podcast platform you use. that would really, really help other people see it. Also, we are still thinking about the theme of our last episode, so let us know what other emotions topic you'd like us to discuss by leaving us a review or emailing us.
And of course, share with all your friends and family. Please join us next time as we explore the neuroscience of helping others in the episode, The Altruistic Brain. We hope you'll stay safe, take care of yourself and of each other.